This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest historian Gary Wills has been thinking about the role of religion in public life, and he says the influence of evangelical Christians in the Bush administration is one of several periods in American history when religion has invaded the sphere of government. Earlier surges of evangelism, he argues, have always provoked a popular reaction which reduced their influence. Wills' new book is Head and Heart, American Christianities. He says some modern evangelicals mistakenly believe the founders of the Republic were guided by biblical teaching and that America has gradually lost its spiritual moorings. In fact, Wills says the founders were not deeply religious, and their decision to separate religion from government actually helped America to become a deeply religious society. Gary Wills is a professor of history emeritus at Northwestern University. He's won many awards, including the Pulitzer Prize. Among his many other books are What Jesus Meant and Lincoln at Gettysburg. Well, Gary Wills, welcome back to Fresh Air. You had an encounter with the Dalai Lama in Chicago, which you write about early in this book, which yielded a point relevant to your subject. Would you describe that moment?
Well, yes. He came to Chicago and was scheduled to appear. And he said, I don't like to give formal addresses because they're boring and people fall asleep. So would you please have someone on the stage with me asking questions and I will respond? I was one of those on the stage, and we talked to him ahead of time, and he said, don't ask easy questions. Some people are too deferential to me, and that also is boring, and we all go to sleep. So ask a hard question. Well, the only question I could think of was, if you were restored to your country, what would you do different? And he said, I would disestablish the religion, because the American separation of church and state is the proper relationship between politics and religion.
This from a man of mystical faith. Did this surprise you?
Not surprised, but pleased. But on the way out, I said to him, for that, don't you have to have had an enlightenment, our 18th century scientific, rational enlightenment? And he said, ah, there's the problem. And his very next book said that the Buddhists had not faced up to the difficulty of dealing with modern rationality and science. So he wanted to get to where we started, where we had the great luck to start in the 18th century with deist formulators of our government who knew that the best thing for religion is to separate it from the state. Both Madison and Jefferson said that religion will flourish if it is separated from the state, because in all of the governments that had established religions, religion became contaminated by politics, became corrupt, caused a reaction of anti-clericalism and disgust with the relationship between the two. And that has never happened in America, and no country, no developed country, has a higher degree of religious profession and attendance than the United States. And it's really, I think, due to the fact that we did have a separation of church and state.
Well, you write early in the book that this separation of church and state, which, you know, we use the shorthand disestablishment for, you say it was a stunning innovation and the only original part of the Constitution. What do you mean?
That's right. No other country before ours had dared to launch itself without formal protection by God, by some official religion. Everything else in the Constitution, the tripartite government, the independent judiciary, federalism, bicameralism in the legislature, all of those things had been around for a long time. And the only thing that was new was to say, we don't need an official cult. And a lot of people said, of course you do. How could you hope to flourish if God is not blessing you? Well, we launched it, and it worked.
And you note that this innovation, the separation of church and state, could have only occurred at this particular moment in our history. What was unique about that moment?
Well, You know, we have a myth in America that we began as a very religious country and we've been declining in religiosity ever since, which is the exact opposite of the truth. We were at our lowest level of religiosity in the 1770s when 17% of the people were churchgoers. And our profession and practice of religion took off like crazy after the Constitution was founded. A tremendous explosion in the early 19th century, the Methodist explosion especially, when there were more Methodist pastors than post office officials. And the thing is that it would have been hard to persuade religious people that they could get along without an official cult at any other time. But the deist founders, and they were all deists, which doesn't mean atheists, they were rational believers, were the ones who were able to pull off this really astonishing new thing.
And since you raised the subject, I mean, people have talked about the founders of the Republic as being deists. What exactly did that mean?
Well, they believed that God did create the world and supervises it, governs it. They believed in providence, so that Thomas Paine, for instance, said that he can't believe that God is not on the side of freedom, not so much as a matter of this government or that government, but just in general. And they believed in the afterlife. They didn't, most of them, believe in God's responding to prayer. They said, you know, God knows what's best. He doesn't wait for us to ask him to do something and then does it on our bidding. They didn't believe in the particulars of Christian revelation. They believed that Jesus, well, Locke believed that Jesus was the Messiah who had been promised in Jewish scripture, but that he was not God incarnate, that he was an important moral leader singled out by God. Jefferson thought that he was the most perfect moral teacher, but was simply a perfect man, not God. So they had various degrees of recognition of God's intervention in human life, but most of them thought that established churches were corrupt, and we shouldn't believe what they say, that we should believe our reason. We know that God is around and made the world because the world works so beautifully, and nobody could do that without him.
And so the imperative for those of us here below was to live moral lives and would be rewarded with an afterlife?
That's right. Jefferson said to Adams when Abigail Adams died, "It's a terrible blow that you've received, but we'll soon be joining her in the afterlife and enjoy her company forever." So they did have some very important and emotional religious beliefs.
You dwell at some length on the separation of state and religion by the founders of the Republic, and it's interesting that you note early on that the logic of having an established religion is simple and appealing. What is the logic?
Well, that if you do not pay right deference to God, he will not bless your endeavors. And therefore, you must make sure that the state is properly deferential to God. The thinking there is that God will only bless a nation, a polity, if there is a formal recognition of him. The trouble with that, of course, is that there's been formal recognition of him by every state that preceded ours, and obviously he's not protecting them all because when two of them fight with each other, one wins, and therefore the magic didn't work.
Now, at the time that at the founding of the Republic, of course, there were governments already in place up and down the colonies. How much religious freedom was allowed then in the laws and charters and practice of the individual colonies?
Well, as I say, the separation of church and state was a brand new idea. So in the colonies, it had not been observed. There were official religions in many colonies. There were conditions for holding office that said you had to believe in the Trinity or you had to believe in Jesus Christ. And the first one that really broke away from that was the state of Virginia. Jefferson wrote a statute of religious freedom, which he tried to get through, and he didn't at first, and he said it was the hardest fight of his life because it was so resented in Virginia. But when he had left and gone to France as our legate, Madison finally got it through. And that was the first one. The first one in history and in the world that had a real religious freedom statute.
You know, and you focus on a petition drafted by James Madison, which was, you know, not from the Constitutional Convention, but from that he did in opposition to a Virginia tax that was to be levied to support ministers. And you call his arguments the best exposition of the thought that would lie behind the drafting of the First Amendment, and in fact, the best arguments for separation of church and state that have ever been written. What did Madison say in this draft?
Well, he said what Jefferson said, that no one can take away the right of the individual to worship God in whatever way he or she wants. But he spells it out in great detail, and he says religion, the state should have no cognizance of religion. It should not know about it even. It should just keep its hands off, so much so that later on he said, it's better when we have the census of American citizens, which is mandated in the Constitution, that religious ministers not give their profession, because the state has no business knowing that. It has no business knowing anything about religion. It should just keep entirely away from it. Now, that seems very extreme to most people, and we have not observed it in our history. He didn't want, for instance, to have chaplains who wore the uniform of the United States and took salaries from the United States, although they were religious pastors. He didn't want chaplains in the Congress. He didn't want tax exemption for churches. We've never gone that far in following his principles, but logically, we should have, and it's always been dangerous not to. More and more, as this new idea came over us, we began to accept it. Now, when I was a young person in school, I knew many of my friends who were in public schools and had to say the Our Father every day, or they had to do other religious practices. We don't do that anymore. And that was resisted mightily when the Supreme Court said that we should stop doing it.
How did people in the colonies react to a constitution that did not mention God?
Some were very upset, of course. But all that the Constitutional Convention could say is that the federal government will make no law about religion, which left the individual states, of course, to keep established religions so far as they had them still. And some people have actually claimed that the constitutional arrangement was to allow the states to keep their own establishment. Well, we know that was not Madison's view because of what he had already done in the state of Virginia, and he thought, obviously, that other states should do that too. But it took a while for the states to disestablish their own religion practices, and as time went by, the federal government was applied to the state level through the 14th Amendment, and now we have the disestablishment applying to us all.
You know, there is a notion among, I guess, some historians that the separation of religion from government was a necessary accommodation to the proliferation of religions and sects up and down the colonies, that it wasn't principle, it was pragmatism.
Yes, that's a very common idea, that we did have different religions. We had Catholics in Maryland, we had Quakers in Pennsylvania, we had Calvinists all through New England, we had Anglicans in New York and in the southern, and therefore there couldn't have been one established religion. And that's the only reason. But that's not the argument that was made by Jefferson and Madison or others. And as a matter of fact, when the Constitution was ratified, various states sent in objections to things, and none of them argued that you've got to protect our established church in our state. That was not what the argument was about. So at the time, no one was really promoting this new idea on the grounds that it was a necessary compromise. They were promoting it in principle, that freedom of conscience had to be respected.
If the founders believed in this more rational notion of God, that he was revealed through reason and study, you write that as the Republic progressed, there have been periods of evangelistic fervor. I mean, the Second Great Awakening in the early 19th century, and then again in the early 20th century when there was all of the revivalism which led to prohibition of alcohol. What was the reaction of the Republic and the population generally to this spirit of evangelism, and what was the effect of that reaction on the strength of religion in the Republic?
Well, one of the problems with enlightened religion is that it seems too cool and desiccated and cerebral, and it doesn't have a religion of the heart, and therefore there's a great appeal in the revivalistic strain that I choose Jesus and the Spirit chooses me, and I don't wait for an outside intellectual to tell me what God is like. So always that is there. So I describe a kind of two poles of attraction in America between the head and the heart. And sometimes it becomes really ardent. The Second Great Awakening was one of those cases. The fundamentalist movement at the beginning of the 20th century, and right recently, the religious right. All of those have gone to excess, it seems to me, and the reaction to the fundamentalist movement with prohibition and the Scopes trial and things like that was, wait a minute, this has gone too far. And the reaction to the religious right recently has been on the Terry Schiavo case, for instance. The 81% of the people in America said that they disagreed with Congress interfering in the Terry Schiavo case. And a number of moderate Republican religious people have begun to say we've gone too far in this kind of vendetta against gays, etc.
So it's not the growth of evangelistic feeling that produces the reaction, but breaching the wall of separation with the state that really...
Sure, there's nothing wrong with religious feeling, but when it starts trying to take over the functions of government, then people begin to have some misgivings.
What evidence do you see that there is a reaction now against the Bush administration's embrace of evangelicals?
Well, as I say, the moderate religious people have started shifting their emphases, if not actually renouncing what had gone before. For instance, there's a whole evangelical group that is saying the environmental measures of the Bush administration have gone way too far. And that was always something that the religious right had been involved in their view of dominion over nature. That has changed. The saliency of the gay issue and the abortion issue have diminished in polls. So they're running out of steam, and they're becoming more uneasy about what they've got themselves in for. So one of the things that Rove was good at was to rev up the troops on all kinds of issues without getting too much into the concerns of the independents so that they would rebel against this. Well, that's not happening anymore. They are rebelling against it.
Well, and you find very significant the statements of Senator John Danforth here. Why do you cite those?
Well, he is such a stalwart of the conservatives. You know, he brought a suit against Roe v. Wade. He supported Clarence Thomas for the Supreme Court. He's a very long-standing, important member of the religious right. And for him to say, we've gone too far, folks, we've got to stop this, is very significant.
Well, Gary Wills, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Historian Gary Wills, his new book is Head and Heart, American Christianities.